The Engineering Commons is a podcast dedicated to the challenges that engineers encounter, regardless of which industry or field they work in on a regular basis. These can be overarching topics that affect us over our entire careers, or stories of everyday frustrations and how to deal with them. This is the episode for the 27th of June, 2013, in which we discuss fitting in with experts from beyond the engineering realm.
So, Jeff, have you ever had to fit in an environment that seemed quite foreign?
Well, sure. I mean, when you're a kid, if you move around, and we moved around a few times, you'd go to a new school and you didn't know anybody, and idioms were different and the clothes were different. And so you kind of struggled at first trying to fit in and figure out what was cool. But yeah, I mean, later on in life, though, as an engineer, though, you sometimes get thrown into meetings, you know, get thrown into a meeting with the marketing department or the accounting department, or they say, go in, you've got, you know, we've got four vice presidents in this room, go update them on your project. And, you know, they start speaking some sort of language about return on investment and overhead. And you go, you know, Lord, what am I doing in here? So yeah, there.
So it's like a professional culture shock.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So it's from time to time you run into those cases where, you know, you just have to feel your way along and see if you can figure out what's happening. So there's no doubt that it's really important sometimes to be able to adjust what you say and how you develop or deliver your message, depending on what your audience is. And so I think it's true when we have non-engineers come into an engineering world, we have to try to understand where they're coming from and what their needs are and what they're trying to tell us, as well as when we go into a different environment, you know, how to share our message to others. So today we're going to talk about fitting in. This process of trying to invite others into our engineering world, so to speak, as well as the process that we go through when we have to go deliver our message in other cultures, in other environments. Today, we're going to have a listener joining us as a guest on the Engineering Commons. And again, I'd like to issue an invitation to all our listeners. If you'd like to share your engineering story, please contact us at admin@theengineeringcommons.com. And we'd love to have you as a guest on the show. So our guest for this episode is Paul Davis, who is a computer science major who's found himself working as an engineer and having to regularly deal with other engineers. Paul, how are you doing this evening?
Doing good, Jeff. Glad to be here. It's an honor and privilege.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I certainly appreciate your willingness. You were the first brave one to contact us and say, I'm willing to do this.
Oh, wow. Okay. Cool.
So you're a computer science major, correct?
That's right. Degree, bachelor's in computer science.
Okay. And what led you to pursue that degree?
I'd been messing with computers since, I guess I was 10 or 11. And when it came time to go to college, it was a natural choice to take that route. I did have an interest in engineering, but at the time, I don't think I really had the mental preparation to go into that field. Whereas I had an interest in electrical engineering, to be specific, but computers just seemed more natural to me, more accessible. You know, I had no problems understanding computer science topics as opposed to looking at schematics, you know, electromagnetic theory and whatnot.
And were you happy with your choice of CS as a major? I mean, I know a lot of people who get into programming and then they get into computer science and they say, this isn't really programming. This is, you know, this is math about programming.
Yeah. I think the late, great Edgar Dijkstra was a Dutch computer scientist. Mm-hmm. He said it the best when he said, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, computers are to computer science what telescopes are to astronomy. You're not really studying computers per se. It is, as you said, the mathematics, the theory behind it, mm-hmm. which I actually found fascinating. So that part I enjoyed. We do study a specialized field of math called discrete math, which has all kinds of things like logic, set theory, ring theory, graph theory, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. As opposed to continuous math, which is what you guys would specialize in, you know, differential equations, integration, stuff like that.
Right.
And, but I found that all interesting and And you do, of course, do programming to get assignments done and get real practical results, but that's actually secondary. So, yeah, if you're going in thinking it's just a programming course, you're actually mistaken.
Right. And so where did you go to school for your undergrad?
I went to State College in New Jersey, in Jersey City. It's okay. Now called New Jersey University or something. They changed the name, but that's where I went for my undergrad. And it was a pretty good experience.
Was there a particular focus in the CS program at your university?
No, they didn't really specialize in any particular area. You could take courses if you wanted to in maybe assembly language or graphics or more theoretical. I actually took a couple courses in computability theory, which is things like Turing machines, very abstract computation, like what is computation type questions, which gets pretty theoretical and pretty complicated pretty fast, but it's interesting stuff. So that was kind of my main area of interest, but there was no specialized, you know, sub majors or minors, you know, so to speak, with that program. It was a pretty well-rounded one.
You didn't think you were ready for taking engineering type courses. You thought about it, but it sounds like if you could handle that kind of math, you could certainly handle the engineering math.
It's different though, Jeff. It's like, you know, I did take Calc 1 in, as an elective for my bachelor's. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I know derivatives. I know integration. I don't really remember them so much now, but, you know, limits and differential equations, but you know, basic trig and whatnot. But I don't know, discrete math, not that I'm a math whiz by any means, but it made more sense. It was more approachable than, you know, calculus is. And without that foundation in calculus, you're not really going to get too far with, you know, electromagnetic theory, you know, Maxwell's equations and things like that. So I still kind of have that, you know, I do deal with calculus in my current position in terms of, you know, PID controllers and things like that. So I don't deal with it directly, but you have to kind of know the background and how it works and what it is, even if you don't apply it directly, which is a point I think you guys have made numerous times, that you don't apply this stuff directly anymore, but you got to know what it is. At the time I just wasn't ready for it. And that is a bit of a source of regret for me.
Then again, it does say quite a bit about you that you took calculus as an elective. Something positive, I should say.
I needed to fill the schedule, and I wanted to do it. I wanted to say I can do this, and there you go. I did.
As a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. I've got a friend who is still in the controls department that I recently got out of at Purdue, but he is contemplating. You obviously do PID loops, control loops. You can either do it in continuous time or discrete time. And the problem you have is that normally can't be introduced until, say, your junior year to undergrads, because you don't have enough of the calculus to do the controls work. But certainly almost all the control loops, modern control loops, are done in discrete time digitally. And so the concept is there a way to teach, you know, high school students or beginning college students control theory using discrete controls, because now you no longer have calculus. It's all addition and subtraction and multiplication. So you were saying that you couldn't get into engineering because you didn't have a big handle on the continuous math. And I think that it's interesting that other people are contemplating, is there a way to get around that problem so we can get people started on engineering a little earlier?
I guess you can. I'll say you can, because I don't have I understand what I'm doing with regards to the particular task. And I have an idea of what that little utility is doing, the PID utility is doing. But in terms of really understanding it at a I like to understand things at a fairly deep level like that, just so I know exactly what's going on. And I don't think I really have that so much. It's not a hindrance. I can still do my job effectively. But I think ultimately you should always, even if you never really, really use it, you should learn, you know, the fundamentals of it. And I think that was my major problem. I didn't think I could actually, at the time, really get to learn the fundamentals as well as I wanted to.
Okay. Well, let me just say I'm the poster child for it's never too late to go back to school. So
I'd also like to recommend that to anyone listening, I don't think you ever fully understand each of your calc classes until the next calc class.
Yes.
Because that was, I felt totally lost in calc one. And then for whatever reason, when I got to calc two, everything I did in calc one made sense. And same thing going forward when I got to vector calc, et cetera. Oh man, everything. This is simple. Yeah, easier said than done, because then you have to suffer through it the first time.
I would agree with that, yeah. Definitely, you look in retrospect at what you've done, and you're like, oh, okay, I see where it all fit in. My other issue, too, is if I can't see a direct application for something, I have a hard time grasping it. And, you know, a lot of calc classes can be kind of dry, and you're just looking at tangents to curves and things like that, which is all well and good. But if I'm not seeing an application for it, I start to kind of lose interest in it. And then that's kind of a blocking thing, at least for me.
You're not the only one, Paul.
Okay.
There's lots of us that really struggled trying to understand what some of that math theory was all about. And it started to make sense when you saw the application, at least for me. You'd start to apply it, and then you go, oh, now this is, you know, it starts to make sense. But before that, it was just theory to be memorized so you could get through the course. So, Paul, you got your undergrad degree in computer science. Did you find a job immediately after graduating, or did you find something else? I know you got your master's. Did you move on immediately to your master's degree?
I didn't. I got a job immediately after graduating from my undergraduate. Not doing any kind of software development. It seems like, at least at the time, that the natural progression was CS degree, you move into IT. Mm-hmm. And usually the junior man on the pole is, you know, doing help desk work, which is terribly unsatisfying, to put it mildly. My first position was with an ISP. This was in the mid-90s, so just when the internet was trying to explode into the public consciousness. Mm-hmm. And your primary means of getting on the internet was via dial-up. So I was doing support with getting people either selling a service or getting people able to dial into our modem bank and get on the internet.
Is that the nightmare I imagine it to be?
Yes. Yes, it is. If a prospective customer would say internet as if it were two separate words, yes, you knew you were in for a very long call. Just heard about it. Internet, yes.
You got to put that A in there. Intra and internet were used indistinguishably. Mm. It's all a series of tubes.
So, and at the time it was Windows 3.1 with a tool named WinSock that you have to configure. And the Mac software was easier, as it usually is, but... Yeah, so it could be challenging at times. And then from there, I moved to another position as an operations person for a financial printing company. And they had a VAX VMS set up in their data center. Mm-hmm. And they had offices all over the country and the world. But their main data center was in New Jersey. And they had a VAX cluster. I don't know if either of you guys are familiar with the VAX system, but it's basically a mini computer system.
Right.
And in its heyday, it was made by Digital Equipment. And in its heyday, it was big iron, big data processing.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was third shift operations. So that's, you know, add accounts, do backups, things like that. But not much development other than scripts to, you know, automate administration tasks. So, you know, I was seeing that it's basically IT work, no software development, because no one really wants to hire you because you don't really have a lot of experience with software development despite your degree, right? Mm-hmm. So then I decided to go to grad school, and with a particular emphasis on aerospace. And that's how I wound up.
And so how did you pick the particular emphasis on aerospace?
Well, I've always had an interest in airplanes and things like that, and I actually have a private pilot certificate, so I've always liked things that flew, and I wasn't going to be a professional pilot or a test pilot or anything, so I could at least get into the field through this route, and certainly with modern airplanes, a lot of things are automated and fly-by-wire and things. So software is a big part of it, bigger now than it was.
Right. So, and where did you find a grad school that had this emphasis?
Embry-Riddle in Daytona Beach, Florida.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
So what do you guys – where do you guys go for spring break?
Ha. It seems like everybody comes down there. It's funny. I would see the oddest thing I saw were high school students driving from Canada for spring break, you know, all the way from Manitoba and Alberta, which is way, way, way up there. But, yeah, it would get pretty pretty busy during spring break, and you'd always have reports of spring breakers falling off their balconies at the hotel and so on. So,
right.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
How would you describe Embry-Riddle's relationship with the aerospace industry? Would you consider it like a magnet school for aerospace?
Certainly for pilots, it always has been, because they have a pilot training. It's an undergraduate mm-hmm. course. So you get a degree at the end. But for pilot training, it has, I would say it is. They were just launching the software engineering graduate program when I got there. And they were actually doing it in conjunction with maybe in association with, I should say, Carnegie Mellon up in Pittsburgh. Because mm-hmm. the whole idea was software engineering. We're not talking just programming, how to write C programs or you know, abstract computer science stuff. But you want to write a complex piece of software that's maintained by hundreds of people over a 20-year time period, that sort of thing, programming in the large. And companies were having a hard time finding people that could do this because now software was becoming a bottleneck on its own, right? You know, over budget, not working right, not what we wanted, so on and so forth. So the whole thing about the software engineering program was to get people out there that could actually do the whole thing, you know, from requirement solicitation to architecture, design, writing the code, testing it, releasing it, and so forth. So they were keen on doing that, and the Carnegie Mellon has a software engineering institute, which has the what they used to call the CMM, the Capability Maturity Model for Software Development. It's a five-level scale where you have one being completely chaotic to five being a shop that has a well-defined software development process that's repeatable, and you know what you're doing, basically. So my school kind of got into an association with that institute at that school at Carnegie Mellon and devised a curriculum that taught these concepts with the idea being that you'd have well-rounded software engineers in quote marks,
right,
that could develop software primarily, you know, for the aerospace industry because that was the focus of the school. But any big software project, it could be for, you know, financial, train industry, you know, railroad, you name it.
Right. So how would you describe the difference between the focus in your CS undergrad and this software engineering program in grad school?
The grad program was certainly more practical. The mm-hmm. you know, in the undergraduate, we had a class that we took that was a required class for a class that was called software engineering, but it really wasn't. You know, you're talking about the waterfall model of software development, that sort of thing. You know, basically you work out what you want to do, you design it, you write code, you test it, and you go down in a staircase type fashion, right? And that was about it. You're not really, you know, write self-documenting code and use descriptive names, that sort of thing. Just good practices, but nothing spectacular. And the graduate program, though, is much more practical. It's like, you know, how do you get requirements from someone? What methods do you use to make sure that your requirements, that what you get from the person is what they actually meant? How do you make note of these requirements so that you can look at them later and know exactly what was agreed upon, right? You know, formal methods for explaining complicated things where natural language doesn't really quite work. You know, stuff like that, basically.
Yeah, this sounds like it'd be good stuff for a lot of engineers. There's a lot of times you have to go in and talk to the subject matter expert and try to extract for them what the, you know, the requirements for the machine or the requirements for the IC chip or whatever it is. And a lot of times that's a difficult thing because the English language or natural language doesn't cover all the multitude of possibilities.
It can be very inadequate. One of my favorite classes and one of the hardest one was Introduction to Formal Methods, which is methods that you use to – you use mathematics to basically precisely explain what it is you're trying to accomplish. And this class used a specific – they call it a language, but it's not a programming language. It's a specification language called Z, which is a British system. And it uses – let me see if I can remember – axiomatic set theory as its – definition language. So you're basically using, you know, I don't know what you got to remember about set theory, but you have unions and intersections and is an element of and things like that.
Right.
You're basically using that kind of notation in what they call a schema to specify exactly what it is you're trying to do. And a case study they used was the lighting system in the cockpit of the A330 passenger jetliner. Mm-hmm. Apparently the various ways you can have things being lit up was way too complicated to explain, you know, in English or French, I guess. So Zed was used to be, you know, explicit in how you wanted things to work. That's like the most practical, I think, course in that whole curriculum, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like it'd be mighty useful, like I said, to a lot of engineers and a lot of other areas.
Yeah, I think it would be. It's very difficult to pick up, though, which maybe is the reason why you don't see formal methods as much, except for maybe all but the most safety critical, cannot fail in any way, you know, systems.
Right.
But I guess the closest you're going to get to engineering in software as what I call traditional engineering disciplines like yours, Jeff. Or Brian's, you know, it's real, tangible, based on a solid mathematical foundation. In fact, my instructor for that class, the formal methods class, said, you know, all the other engineering disciplines have a strong mathematical foundation. Why shouldn't, you know, software development? And this is an attempt to do so.
Right.
For good reason, right? You can't just guess at what values you want to use for a, you know, a structure or something. You have to know the laws and the rules and how to and have a mathematical foundation for it. Why should computer programming be any different?
I've claimed in the past that what really differentiates software engineers from what, you know, physical world engineers is having to deal with entropy.
Mm.
You know, the civil engineers have to worry about the ground shifting and the mechanical engineers have to worry about steel rusting or materials deteriorating. Electrical engineers have to worry about, you know, capacitors failing. And in a purely abstract world, computers don't have that problem. You know, a bit is a bit, and the code should run forever as long as, you know, the electricity is still on.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not in reality. In fact, I had a post I put on my blog once that said, I have to admit that software engineers are engineers because they have to deal with the fact that the code is always changing and the equipment is always changing. And in a certain sense, you have to, as you design and write the code, you have to accommodate for that future change in equipment, just the same way that a civil engineer has to worry about, you know, the steel failing if or diminishing its strength because someone hasn't properly maintained it.
Perhaps I'm being a little unfair to my colleagues in the software engineering business, but I'm still having a problem considering software engineering as an engineering discipline at this point. It may very well be one in the future, but I think given the current state of the art, I don't think we're quite there yet. I think a lot of the concepts that what I'll call traditional engineers have as a heritage in the field, we're not quite finished establishing yet in this field.
Right.
So it's software engineering as it stands is trying to put something, a formal framework or formalize, you know, computer programming.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to admit it, in many of the aerospace embedded systems I've worked on, the software is by far the most complex part of the system.
Absolutely. It is. It is because, for a couple reasons, I guess. One is that you can infinitely tweak it versus, you know, real life things. You can't, you can only do so much, so many transformations to it. Otherwise, you get something different or doesn't work. With software, you can tweak it infinitely almost to kind of get what you want. But
I mean, yeah, that might lead to upfront, you know, we always complain that the software engineers could hit compile and it takes us, you know, a week to spin a board or a month, was more like it. But at the same time, you know, we could change a component and do a pretty quick analysis as to what the implications are. As you change your software structures, I mean, it's very difficult to justify any changes that are being made as having no impact on either your verification or validation regimes.
It's part of that infinite tweakability of it that is also its biggest weakness, because you decide to do something, hey, I can just tweak this just to get this result. But what we have a hard time appreciating is exactly how that is going to ripple through everything else. It might be, you know, go through everything else in a benign fashion, or it could introduce a subtle problem. And a lot of the things I've encountered are problems that were basically a result of a change done that was pretty innocuous at the time, but had completely unintended consequences, which, you know, you would see in traditional engineering as well. But in software, it's just magnified, I think, pretty strongly and pretty quickly. More so than, I guess, physical things. At least that's my impression.
So, I mean, I guess the point I'd like to make, though, is that in terms of the responsibility of the project, the quality and safety of your project, software engineers have, you know, a disproportionate effect on that. And they have substantial responsibility for the ultimate quality of the product.
They do. I mean, you know, for a lot of aerospace things, you'll see that the hardware has been pretty much designed, agreed upon, constructed, and it's pretty much there. Now it's just a question of getting the software to move the hardware the way you want it to, right? And that's the thing that, you know, makes or breaks the product. A lot of times, for example, you'll see that you have a problem with the hardware. Rather than have a hardware fix, you'll tweak the software so that, in the case of a jet engine, for example, it's doing something that you don't want it to do. You'll patch the software so that that particular situation is avoided. You know, so you move the throttle, you know, a certain way, and rather than have a mechanical system prevent it from doing something, you'll just have the software say, well, pilot, move the throttle, but I'll hold back for this amount of time before I allow, you know, the afterburner to light or something as a fix for a hardware problem. And it's a cheap fix because you're not designing hardware all over again. It weighs a lot less because bits are pretty light. And it's very powerful in that sense.
I just had to let the phrase, the jet engine isn't doing what you want it to do, kind of roll over me. I'm trying to imagine what that might be.
It's pretty impressive when they misbehave. Trust me. Yeah. And it's not always software doing it either. Sometimes they'll throw a blade or have other issues, and it's pretty spectacular. Yeah.
Departure events.
Departure events, yeah. We're uncommanded this, we're uncommanded that. You know, those are all very bad. And then it doesn't have to be something that's like bad in the sense that it's failing. It's just bad in the sense that I really don't want it to do that. You know, for performance reasons or for, you know, efficiency or whatever, it's doing something that you just don't want it to do. So it's a requirement issue or something like that. So the software generally lets you fix these things without resorting to a hardware fix necessarily. And that's pretty neat. Kind of forgot what your original point was, Brian, though, from this discussion.
Engines doing bad things,
right. So, you were saying that software has a disproportionate effect on the overall quality of the final product, which it does.
Yes, meaning that you shouldn't downplay the importance of the role that software engineers play in it.
Not the role that software engineers have. It's just that, I guess, calling it engineering may be a little generous at this point, because I don't think it's really an engineering discipline quite as of yet.
That battle's already been lost. People, you talk engineering and people say software engineer, and they have, if they're not familiar with either programming or, you know, what we traditional engineering disciplines, it makes no difference to them. And we get a call for, we need more STEM graduates, we need more engineers. You look at the hiring trends. Yeah, we need a lot more software engineers, but the hiring trends in the other engineering, the traditional engineering disciplines, are pretty flat. So as far as terminology, the battle's lost. Software engineers are going to be called engineers.
I would agree with that. But let me give you an example here. You have a lot of engineers, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, who, you know, wind up sitting behind a desk and they're writing, you know, control software for, say, a jet engine, right? Or maybe they're writing software, a protocol stack, you know, an RF protocol stack for a mobile phone. And, you know, they're double E's or ME's, as the case may be. And, you know, they know things. They know, in the case of a mechanical engineer, I guess, they'll know things about torque motors and moments of inertia and whatever. But here they are writing code. And maybe they're doing that with assistance of a programming tool, or they're writing straight code. But they have that domain knowledge, and they can sit down and write code and create the code that, you know, defines the product. But you're not going to have right. someone who's just a software engineer, mind you, coming in and designing doing something with mechanical engineering or electrical engineering. It doesn't flow in both directions. So I guess my litmus test is that, okay, so I'm a software engineer, I mean, I can't just cross over into the hard engineering disciplines like you guys can with software. Even if your software development experience is limited to what you're doing in a specific field, and it's very elementary stuff, you're still doing the software process, the software, you know, design process, development. You're not going to see software engineers crossing over and doing more of the hard stuff. You know, they may have an idea of what a torque motor is, or, you know, how a LVDT works or something like that, but, you know, just enough to get the job done maybe, but you know what I'm saying? It's not.
Yeah, I understand. On the other hand, there's a lot of engineers that have just the theory and can't seem to figure out how to get, you know, from the equation to what actually needs to happen with the device.
Right. So
I want to get back to engineers trying to be programmers, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of good subject matter we can cover there. But I just want to get back to, so you are going through school at Emory-Riddle. Now, were there other engineers, I mean, non-software engineers, were like aero and mechanical engineers at that school?
It's a funny thing you say that, you mentioned that, you asked that, because when I was probably the second incoming class for this program, and they require that you have a computer science background for obvious reasons. So we're sitting in mm-hmm. the conference room with the head of the chair of the department, and he's going over some requirements they have in terms of undergraduate courses that they want people to take, so they have that baseline. And right. a lot of the people coming in were not computer science. Actually, all except for me were not computer science majors. They were either aerospace engineering or some other field, and they were all moaning at the fact that they had to take some background CS courses, you know, to right. come up to speed. And I was the only one who could just walk in and start taking the core curriculum for the software engineering, because I had the background. And that surprised me. I'm like, what are you guys doing here? I mean, a lot of these people got their bachelor's in aerospace engineering and had designed wing sections and things like that upstairs in the wind tunnel lab, and you know, had done CFD on the workstations upstairs, mm-hmm. and they were all jumping onto the software development thing. And that struck me as, well, for two reasons. One is like, wow, you guys all want to change careers all of a sudden. And the second thing was, well, what does it say about software engineering if you can you just hop into it with essentially no background? I mean, yeah, they took some courses mainly because the school wanted them to, but if they could write code in C or Ada, I mean, that's all they really needed to do. Nothing we did was theoretical computer science or anything. They certainly couldn't tell me anything about, you know, designing algorithms or, you know, Big O notation or, you know, anything about assembly language necessarily. I don't know, pick a computer science topic.
How the compiler worked.
How a compiler worked, even though as a practical – well, it's good to know, I guess, if you're having problems making library modules together or something, but they couldn't do any of that. They could write code. They could do it fairly well, I guess, but, you know, what does it say about the software engineering field if you could just kind of quote-unquote fall into it like that? You know, I'm not going to wake up one day and design a wing section or, you know, a power transmission system or anything like that without a lot of background that, you know, not one or two courses, but, you know, a whole undergraduate, you know, background, you know, to start off with. So that was kind of my first inkling that, you know, maybe engineering is a little bit of a generous term, but we'll leave it aside for now. You know, we'll leave that aside and see, you know, see what happens. And going through the program, a lot of these, you know, my fellow students, you know, they did very well, and certainly it's very practical. So you're not worrying about theoretical stuff so much, but just how to get, like I was saying earlier, how do you elicit requirements? How do you design do an architectural design of a program? How do you do a formal design and a low level design? How do you tie it all together so that you can have traceability between what the requirement says, what part of design fulfills that requirement, how you're testing that requirement? So it's all very practical, and for an engineer, that's like natural, right? So.
Well, for some more than others.
Some, you know, perhaps.
We've talked before about how engineering school sort of trains you to break problems into small pieces and how to approach it. And that's one of the major benefits of going through an engineering education. And so I'm curious whether when you took engineers basically out of the engineering realm and you stuck them into the software realm, whether their problem-solving abilities were at all evident, whether it was helpful, whether you noticed any difference in the way that they attacked problems as opposed to, you know, maybe the computer science majors you knew would approach problems, whether it really didn't matter. You were all into a new realm anyway.
I guess almost it didn't matter. A lot of times engineers will use a front-end tool to, you know, I guess the classic example is a thermostat control, right, that you can design using Simulink. So it's a graphical design, and you can basically have data flowing through a system, and that insulates you from a lot of the low-level stuff that you never really have to worry about, and that you might not even ever be aware of either. And from that perspective, if you're doing it that way, you can actually get engineers up to speed very quickly with using software, and you have a set way of doing things, and that's it. You never really have to worry about much at all. And your only concern is, you know, how do I get, you know, this behavior from this system that I want? And then you use your engineering knowledge to work that out, you know, your domain knowledge to work that out. So if you're using a front end like that, then I think they do fairly well. It's only when you need to get lower that things lower level rather that things start to fall apart, that, you know, you're not really sure about basics of computer architecture. You know, what's going on here? Why doesn't this quite work? You know, things like that. Now, if you're writing software traditionally, like you're writing like, you know, using text like C code or Ada or something, then I think the lack of a CS background is a little bit more problematic because you're dealing with things at a lower level and you don't have any tools that are automating things away or abstracting things away for you. So then you have a bit of a learning curve, and some engineers just aren't programmers or software developers. That's not their thing. They didn't go to school for that.
Right.
And I guess to Brian's point earlier, where software is the thing, that the quality definer, that's why a lot of engineers are doing software. I mean, since a lot of the control stuff, using a specific example for what I'm doing now, is in software versus a mechanical control box that you would put on top of something, you have to know software. You're going to be working with software, like it or not. So, you know, using a front-end tool abstracts a lot of the issues away, and you can just concentrate on doing your job that way. But if you're working with C code directly, especially C, because that's so low level, I mean, the lack of a CS background, I think, is a deficiency, especially when you're doing stuff that's safety critical and has expensive hardware associated with it.
Paul, you don't feel that those high-level tools give people a false sense of security, do you?
No. Most of them are good enough that they have protections to keep you from doing stupid things to a reasonable degree. I've actually run into some issues where I could see what was going on. The emitted code was the way it was because of, you know, I understood what the code generator was doing, not necessarily what the flow diagram was doing for the particular problem, but I could kind of see what the code generator was thinking when it emitted the source code that was later compiled. And, you know, I think because of a background in CS with some compiler design classes, you kind of get an idea of what's going on that way. But if you didn't have that background, you wouldn't see it, you know?
And I've never used the AutoGen tools on Simulink, but given that you're going from a super high-level simulated discrete-time system, when you actually move down to runtime code, I mean, when you have to deal with the fact that, you know, you're trying to build a real-time system and floating-point math takes forever, you never see those type of issues pop up?
Not really, no. In this particular tool that I have experience with, you know, it's meant for this specific domain, so a lot of that stuff is taken care of for you, and you're basically just moving blocks around and using lines to connect them, and it has a nice block diagram look and feel to it, and it's automatically taken care of for you for the most part. But it has its limitations, and sometimes you have to resort to writing source code by hand, you know, in which case, you know, you'll have to use, you have to know something of the language that you're writing in. And in fact, I had a colleague mention once that despite the fact that they do use a tool, a front-end generator like this, you still got to know the ins and outs of, you know, the Ada programming language to know what's going on, you know, in terms of what fell out of scope when, and, you know, what package has this defined and how do you access it. If you don't have that knowledge of the language that you never really see, you know, your diagrams are not going to come out right or not going to work right. So I find the knowledge of the underlying language varies from engineer to engineer. You know, some have no idea of it, don't care. Others are a little bit better with it. So I think it's to your benefit to know these things, right? If there's a problem, you have an idea of what to do to fix it. But again, engineers, you know, you go to mechanical engineering school and electrical engineering school to do that and not necessarily concentrate on writing code so much. So
we sort of have a merging of the fields. The software engineering field is trying to become more math-based so that they've got a more rigorous foundation to be more like, you know, physical engineers, whereas the physical engineers are finding themselves more and more writing code, so they have to adopt the theory and the understanding of the software engineers.
You know, some of the newer guys at work, they're taking your standard mechanical engineering curriculum, and they'll say, I took a programming course, like Intro to C, you know, C 101, you know, just basic stuff, and that's it, nothing else. And
typical. As far as I know, standard, you know, engineering courses, they assume that if you're smart enough to figure out calculus, you can figure out C or Fortran or Python or whatever it is, you know, you want to program in.
Well, 2 points here. I think one is if you're graduating from engineering school now, you can expect to be sitting in front of a computer, not just using like a CAD program or a CFD program or, you know, an EDA program, but you may be actually doing some horror of horrors software development to some extent. You can expect to be doing that. And I think the second point is, if you can figure out Calc 1, 2, 3 and differential equations and tensor math and vector analysis and whatnot, you can figure out how to write something in C, but not necessarily how to write it well or write it correctly. That's not – you can look at a program and understand – you know, okay, this is how you do it, this is what it's doing, it's logical, but I think you're kind of lacking a background in just software.
Actually, I think it's worse than that, where I think if you ask anyone who's taken calculus and said, you know, what's a derivative of x squared, you know, they have an analytical and kind of a rote solution to that. If you ask them to find the derivative of a data set, I think a lot of people stall out unless you have the CS background that you're talking about. I mean, what is the discrete? How do you code a derivative? I know it's very simple, but at the same time, you know, it's not obvious.
Right. Yeah. I've had a few examples of things that I could identify pretty easily that were, 'cause you just know from the computer science background, and by that I mean not the theoretical stuff like computability theory, but, you know, like systems programming, you know, compiler design. I could look at things and identify what went wrong with something, whereas my main engineering colleagues didn't quite see it at first. It was obvious to me outside of the actual problem that we were trying to solve, but I could see, oh, okay, yeah. You look right here, and this is how you backtrack to find this, and you know, it's pretty straightforward, but that's something, you know, you can certainly pick up on your own or just read a book on it, but it's not just a simple, oh, here's how you write a program, just copy it, twiddle with it, and you'll learn how to code, and that's it. It's a lot more in-depth, obviously.
Yeah, I'm afraid that the engineering curriculum, however, is not going to accommodate too much additional content in software development. I mean, they're already trying to cram more and more into the hours that they have. And people are complaining about the fact engineering has stretched basically from a 4-year program to a 5-year program. So
that's what I'm seeing, Jeff. A lot of, you know, new hires that are recent graduates, you know, they'll all say basically have had like minimal exposure to any kind of programming, whether it be with Python or C or anything, you know, JavaScript for that matter. It's either none or very, very limited. So, but they're sitting in front of a computer all day writing code for a design problem that they're using their engineering background for, but they're still designing essentially software.
Okay, so maybe you could address 2 main points when you deal with these engineers that have minimal software engineering background. What are they doing wrong? And then how could they do it more right?
A lot of times with, I guess, you know, regular programming with like in C or something using text, you'll have like a design document which will have help – if it's helpful, will have a data flow diagram or a flow chart or something like that, or a UML chart or something, a state chart to show you, you know, the interactions between different units and everything. And, you know, normally that's – you can always look at that diagram and see, hey, this is very clear, right? And even if the guy who actually codes it in C or something does a horrible, horrible job doing so, that it's completely, you know, it's a winning entry for the obfuscated C contest.
Right?
You can always look at the design document or diagram and know how it works. And I thought that was always going to be the case, but I've actually seen it where the diagram is – an obfuscated diagram. You look at the diagram and it should be obvious as to at a glance how everything is connected to each other, how data moves between different components, and you can't. So I think what engineers are messing up is you can absolutely screw up a diagram to the point where it's almost unmaintainable. And I think that's partially because you're looking at it from your specific, you know, problem-solving background, and you're doing what you need to do, but you have no basis in software development. You're not looking at maintainability or maybe just good design. Even if you're not coding by hand, you know, writing hand code, if you're just drawing a picture that's generated into source code later, you still have a responsibility to write some, you know, design something that's, you know, maintainable for future generations that are going to be looking at this code for decades to come after you've gone to do something else. So,
so it sort of works in both directions, or you're tweaking software to make an engine fix always risks the fact that you've done something that causes a thermodynamic reaction that no one was expecting because the software guy didn't understand what was going on inside the engine. But in the same case, the traditional engineer may be copying and pasting, you know, struggling to figure out, well, how do I make this thing work? I know kind of what I want to do. They find some code on the internet. They copy it. It works. And in the same way that the software engineer may not understand what's going on inside the jet engine, the traditional engineer doesn't understand what's going on inside the computer or compiler, whatever portion of the cycle you want to deal with, and therefore there are unanticipated consequences.
That's exactly right. So that's, I think, what I've seen a lot with engineers who really don't have any kind of software background of any kind. You have to look towards maintainability, readability, and the ability to change things. And sometimes, you know, you get the job done, but not the best way. That was your first one, right, Jeff? And what was your second point?
I was wondering what they did wrong and what engineers could do, how they could do what they do better.
You mean like traditional engineers writing code? Or anything?
So if I'm a 26-year-old mechanical engineer who's come out of school, is in a job, has to deal with some software now because everybody has to deal with software, and has had my one course in, you know, C, my freshman or sophomore year of school, I'm in no way a software expert, but I'm expected to be able to do all this stuff. Is there a course to take, a book to read, an attitude to assume? What do you do to try to deal with, you know, if you recognize your limitations, now what would you suggest that that engineer do?
I think the best thing to do is you've got to write code. And you don't have to do anything crazy with like C. You could just get a Python compiler and write code. And by writing code, I mean do things like structural programming, do object-oriented programming. Do things like write functions, lambda functions, do things like that, just so you get the idea of how you organize software. And you don't have to go super low level or anything, but I think it would be beneficial that, you know, I come across a software problem, you know, what essentially is a software problem that's being developed to solve a real world problem. Mm-hmm. And how would I go about structuring this? You know, what things would I consider as far as, you know, can I scale this up if I need to? Is it easy to change? Is it readable? Things like data types, you know, am I using the right type here? Is there an issue with that? If I need some other software component to look at this code or look at this data, do I have to worry about scoping this to another unit or sub-procedure? You know, we're interfacing with a library. You know, if you just play with just write something in Python, you know, do little mini projects or something, you'll do these, you'll know what these concepts are, you'll know what these considerations are. Whereas if you don't have any background, you're really unaware of them, which is fair because, you know, you never studied it. But I think, you know, if you come in with a general awareness of how software is done, that would go a very long way, I think, in making engineers, you know, more productive with writing code.
Right. Is understanding the concept of testing important, at least in your experience with, you know, the type of code engineers are writing, or is that something that's esoteric and only CS majors should worry about that?
I don't think anybody really gets testing, Jeff.
Okay.
Everybody seems to have their own idea of what this thing is, and you ask any, you know, dozen engineers, software engineers, what testing should encompass, and you'll get a million different answers. I mean, it's I tell you what, every particular firm or shop has their way of testing, what they consider testing, and that could be defined by, you know, the company itself. That could be defined by a standards body that the company has to meet, you know.
Right.
In the case of aerospace, there are various regulatory agencies that dictate what you need to do for certifying software. And in other firms, it's just, you know, basic, you know, the market defines how software should be tested. And that really is a specialized sub-discipline in software engineering, I would say, is verification and testing.
Paul, if there was one thing you could change about the curriculum that undergraduates are seeing coming out of school, what would it be?
Are you talking about engineering?
In terms of producing mechanical, electrical, aerospace people who can contribute to software designs.
I think...
I'm sure it's a list, not just one thing.
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, what struck me most was seeing these new guys come in was that you took all these engineering classes and everything, and you're sitting at a desk in front of a computer, not using the computer as a drafting tool, you know, as you would use a drafting table back in the old days, but you're using a computer as the way to implement something, a behavior or something. And I think you need some software is getting so tightly integrated with everything that it's just going to have to be part of, you're going to have, you know, just as you have, you know, differential equations at some point in your college career there, you're going to have some computer courses, and you don't have to be you shouldn't use a CS curriculum because that's a whole different focus.
Mm-hmm.
But you should definitely have something that has basics of computer architecture and a little bit of, you know, language theory as far as compilers are concerned. And because you're going to be writing code in one way or another. I mean, to give you an example, you can use Simulink to do a nice diagram which spits out code for you, and that's it. But if you're using MATLAB, for example, you know, you're writing programs, and either you know how to or you don't. And by that, I don't mean you know how to use MATLAB's language. I mean you know how to write software. You know, that's something you'll have to. You should be formally trained in, just as with any other aspect of the engineering, you know, discipline, mm-hmm. because it's part of it now, like it or not. You're working with computers. That's just what it is now. I think that's probably the biggest thing. I think you're gonna have to see cost. And I know Jeff mentioned earlier that things are stretched pretty thin as they are to add one more thing to it, but you know. You're writing software that's going to be on an embedded box, and you're going to have to know something about it. And companies do some basic training on embedded software, you know, for engineers. So you know about processes, you know, process and, you know, software engineering process, software process engineering groups and topics about, you know, different types of operating systems and real-time systems versus non-real-time and stuff like that as a you know, to help you get along with what you're doing. But things are getting so sophisticated now that you really have to have as much background in some software development than you do now. You know, more background in it than you do now, I think. That's kind of what I'm seeing.
No, I certainly felt I may be kind of in the group you described. I've never gone full software engineer. That my object-oriented design class was one of, if anything prepared me to write software professionally, I'd say it's that. because it got beyond the initial, hey, here are basic operators. It actually introduced the concepts of abstraction for abstraction's sake, if you will.
Right, yeah. Yeah, actually, it's funny you say that because as an aside, I've seen a lot of software that, you know, in particular, and I guess I can talk about it since I'm not really associated with Motorola anymore and they're no longer associated with Symbian, but Symbian is a smartphone operating system, I guess one of the original ones or the original one, and most of it or the parts that I was involved with was coded in C++, and wow, I mean, I use C++ for other phone projects on Motorola, but the way Symbian did things is they seem to use every single last feature of the language just because it was there. And, you know, I don't know what experience you have with C++, but that can be pretty terse, even when you're coding with objects. And some of their code was just impossible to decipher, you know, because they were using every last feature where you really didn't have to.
Overload every function.
Oh, every function, every operator, templates for everything, and all kinds of crazy things. It just was, wow, guys, you did not have to do this. But anyway, that's just an aside to your point. You can do things for the sake of just doing them and not necessarily come out with a advantage or anything more efficient for having used those things. But I'm
certainly familiar with what you're describing. I should have said abstraction as a tool.
Okay, yeah, okay.
As a positive tool.
Right. Well, I mean, a programming, a graphical front end like Simulink is a very useful abstraction, and it lets you concentrate more on the problem at hand, and it insulates you from a lot of the low level stuff that really you don't have to worry about for the most part. But you know, if things go wrong or don't quite work out the way you thought they would, a lack of a background in any kind of software work, I think, is you'll notice it. You'll be like, what's going on? And if you had that background, you might be able to resolve it pretty quickly. For example, when you do testing, you're writing a script of some sort to run a test case. And that is a form of programming, you know. You're just going to have to do it.
Yeah, Paul, you're now working, I understand, on jet engine technology. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And so you've talked a little bit about what traditional engineers might need to do to come into your realm. What kind of things have you had to do to come up to speed with aeronautical or mechanical engineering knowledge in order to do your job currently?
Well, I had to pick up, thermodynamics, for one. That was helpful. Control theory. Not pick up that stuff. But I know, for example, a jet engine works on the Brayton cycle. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was interesting. And I learned how to look at an entropy enthalpy diagram.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so I'm talking your language there.
Hey, thermodynamics 101.
Yeah, there you go. And from control theory, I know a little bit about feedback loops and, you know, PID controllers. You know, I had to pick up domain knowledge as I went along. I could look at a design diagram and I could see what was being done, which is all well and good. But, you know, if they wanted to change something, to do something, you know, maybe improve a margin somewhere, you know, or make something more efficient, I wouldn't necessarily know how to actually accomplish. What would I do to accomplish that? I wouldn't necessarily know that. I could, if told, I could do it for you. Right. But I wouldn't necessarily be able to figure out, oh, well, obviously you do this because that's how you do it. Right. I mean, there's some things that are hyper specialized that, you know, specific groups, you know, work on, you know, especially things to do with how fuel's burning or, you know, what kind of schedules you should use for different situations. That's actually very, very specific. And, you know, special groups do that, you know, performance analysis and things like that. But just, you know, I want to modify something, you know, I have a PID controller and, I got to modify the gain from this to that. I wouldn't necessarily know that input should be changed from this to that. You know, you can tell me and I can make it happen. But, you know, over time I've gotten somewhat better and I can kind of anticipate what to do as I'm looking over the requirements for the change. But, you know, it's still most of the time an uphill battle. And it's a lifetime career. You're not going to know everything. You're never going to get to that point anyway. But I do feel that not having a background in mechanical engineering or electrical, for that matter, that I am missing some things. You know, to give you an example, LVDTs, right?
Right.
I don't know. I guess you know what that is. So I had to modify some code that dealt with those. And
well, let me back up. That's for those who might not know. Was it linear velocity displacement transducer?
Linear variable displacement.
Linear variable,
yeah.
And so so it looks like a shock absorber,
right?
And so you've got a shaft that moves in and out of a tube, and so I believe it's a magnetic based system. And as the by changing the varying, it's induction, isn't it? I think it's as the induction varies, you're able to tell how far the shaft has moved, and so that's a displacement.
Correct.
Device.
So basically, you have a physical movement that's translated to an electric signal, which you can then manipulate with an onboard computer, essentially.
Right.
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 So that's why they have them. Okay. So you have a mechanical force acting on something and you want to be able to detect that. And that's what the LVDT does. Okay. All well and good. But as you said, you know, there's a rod moving in and out of a shaft that's basically a magnet, and you have, induction, and there are various curves you can look at to see, okay, well, at this position you have the null area where there's no reading, and then either side of that you have curves that out, and they relate to a displacement, and there's some other more details with regards to this. But you know, I understood what the problem was that needed to be resolved, but I had to actually research LVDTs a bit to understand, you know, how they actually work. So when I look at the logic, I can see what the heck it's doing. I mean, I can look at logic and say, okay, if this, then that, jump to this procedure, run this, check that, come back here. That's all well and good, but why are you doing that? And I don't have that answer because I don't know much about LVDTs. So I had to research that to understand the why of why it was doing what it was doing now, so that I'm in a position to change it.
Right.
And, you know, I, of course, I'm mentored and I have colleagues who know this stuff and et cetera, but, you know, my biggest challenge was things like that, just to pick these things up and, pick up domain knowledge essentially. And so I'm able to do my job.
Right. Well, I see you know it better than I do. A quick check of Wikipedia says an LVDT is a linear variable differential transformer. So I got linear correct.
Right.
But velocity is variable and displacement is differential and transducer is transformer. So I only got 25% on that exam.
Close, yeah. But you know, that's where I was when I first came into it. I kind of understood that this was a way to measure a physical displacement and convert it into something that could be used by a computer controlling something else, right?
Right.
But how does it do it? And what do all these damn curves mean? another example would be EHSVs, electro-hydraulic servo valves.
Okay.
Again, that's just a big piece of mechanical equipment, and it's a servo, which is one type of thing, and it's electrical, and so there's electrical consideration. And I look at logic and, okay, it's doing this, that, and the other to make this thing work, but why is it doing these things? You know, if I'm going to modify it, I have to know what I'm modifying. So, researching EHSVs in general and servos in general and electric motors in general.
And when you say researching, where do you start?
I'll look at Wikipedia for one.
That's a good place to start.
And usually the see also or external links will link to a lot of aerospace or mechanical engineering department, various schools. and you can find some pretty good stuff there. I'll also consult the the proprietary documentation for the project I'm working on. They'll have a discussion of, you know, their specific exact, you know, piece of hardware as they have implemented it, as well as details about it. So that's a good obvious source too. But, you know, for a general idea of let's step back all the way back and just look at it in general. You know, I have an electric motor. What are my considerations with it? What am I worried about? You know, there's voltage, there's current, there's Ohm's law. You know, how does it work? What am I thinking about when I'm writing software to run an electric motor? And then let's move up from there and get more advanced. So I can start off pretty low level. Well, not low level, pretty elementary, and then scale up from there.
Well, I see that we've gone well past the hour mark here. So, Paul, we should probably think about wrapping this up so we don't keep you all evening. Although I'm very much enjoying the conversation, so I appreciate your spending some time with us. So do you have any sort of summary advice for, since our audience is mostly engineers, any advice for them about how to deal with non-engineers if they find them in a situation where they have to deal with, in your case especially, someone who has a programming background, how to approach it and how to present the problem in a manner that makes it easier to work together?
Well, I mean, I think from my personal experience, I get along pretty good with the, you know, traditional type engineers. And certainly I think they appreciate my software background, being able to explain things, you know, that I see in code or might be happening, or just an intuition you have when you've worked with software enough and, you know, computer architecture, basically, you have a good, you know, grounding in it. You know, they certainly appreciate that. So I think we all get along pretty good. I think my recommendation for, you know, engineers is that definitely take a programming course of some sort. I would say, you know, get Python and mess with that. I would also recommend learning how to move about in Unix, because invariably you're going to be working on a host platform that runs Unix. And I've seen that for everything from radios to jets to, you know, even financial stuff. You should know how to navigate around Unix, and definitely, just take Python or Ruby or something basic. Don't go crazy and just, you know, learn about software development and the things about the care and feeding of programs. Basically, you know, how do you do these things and like break up problems into separate units and how do they talk to each other? And I think that'll go a long way into, making you comfortable sitting at that workstation your first day, because you will, and be asked to write, develop code, even if it's through a front end of some sort, because you're going to have to do it. And as for software engineers, you know, kind of like a jack of all trades, you're not really studying software engineering for one particular discipline, like finance or, you know, aerospace or you know, whatever the case may be. But, you know, once you have that background, you might look to specialize in this particular area, whether it's like real-time embedded systems or, you know, something to do with the web even. You should look to specialize in something so that you have something of a domain knowledge. You have some sort of domain knowledge of the area you're going to be writing software for, so you can do a good quality job with it. Because it's all well and good to go to school, learn how to write code and learn about the development process. But, you know, then what, right? Unless you know what you're writing for, you're not going to be very effective. So pick a field and specialize in it.
Well, that's terrific advice, and certainly appreciate your willingness to come on and share some of your expertise with us this evening.
It's certainly been a pleasure. I admit I listen with envy to you. Real engineers talking about stuff, and I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. So it's kind of neat that I was able to at least give some insight into software engineering and discuss it with you guys.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I think more traditional engineers are going to be coming to software engineers for the very reasons we discussed, is there are fewer and fewer things you can do without having to go through some sort of software interface. So whether you're programming a device or designing a device or controlling a device, it seems like you have to write code. And so I suspect there'll be a lot of traditional engineers showing up on the doorsteps of software engineers going, how do I do this better?
You know, I had one colleague who he's since left the firm I'm at and has gone to Intel, but he took the hardcore approach. He's an electrical engineering graduate, and halfway through his program, he decided he liked computers a lot, so he went double major and got a CS degree to boot.
Wow.
Wow, yeah. So he was actually very conversant in everything. That's not advisable in all cases, but that's one way of doing it. He was certainly very well-equipped to do a lot of stuff.
Well, and for our listeners who are not quite so ambitious, picking up Python and writing a few lines of code isn't too horribly difficult.
Not at all. It's a very good language for learning. It's very readable. It's a shallow learning curve, so you can straight on doing stuff with it. I highly recommend it.
Terrific. Well, we will let you go this evening. But again, thank you so much, Paul, for coming on and being part of the Engineering Commons.
It's been a pleasure, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Great to talk to you, Paul.
Thank you, Brian.
If you'd like to learn more about Paul's projects and interests, you can visit his website at davissemi.com. That's davissemi.com. And if you'd like to contact him, he can be reached at davissemi@gmail.com. The Engineering Commons is produced by Analog Life, LLC, and Engineering Revision. Theme music by Paul Stevenson. For more info, visit theengineeringcommons.com.